Barry Schwartz back with us, the expert on the Shroud of Turin. You know, ever since we've known about the Shroud of Turin, it has fascinated us, with many believing it is indeed the authentic cloak that was wrapped in the body of Jesus, and that when he resurrected, that smashing boom of electricity or energy, whatever you want to call it, imprinted his entire face and body on the shroud. In a moment, Barry Schwartz on Coast to Coast AM. I shall tell you about our guest before we get rolling here. Barry Schwartz was the official documenting photographer for the Shroud of Turin Research Project. That was a team that conducted the first in-depth scientific examination of the shroud, and that was back in 1978. He's also the founder, editor, publisher of the internationally recognized Shroud of Turin website, the oldest, largest, and most extensive shroud resource on the internet today. In 2009, he founded the Shroud of Turin Education and Research Association, to which he has donated the website and his extensive shroud photographic collection as well. And he was also featured on one of our Beyond Belief episodes that you can find at beyondbelief.com. Barry, welcome back. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great, George, and it's great to be back with you.
For the few people who might not know what the Shroud of Turin is and where it's kept, why don't you tell us about it?
Okay, well, first of all, the Shroud of Turin is called the Shroud of Turin because it's kept in Turin, Italy. It's a 14.5-foot long, 3.5-foot wide sheet of linen cloth that bears the front and back image, ventral and dorsal, full head to toe, front and back, of a crucified, scourged, speared man that was also crowned with a crown of thorns. And the bloodstains that are on it that indicate these wounds are all forensically accurate. And many people, of course, believe that it is the burial shroud of Jesus of Nazareth.
How long have we known about the shroud?
Well, the shroud's history goes back certainly to about the mid-1300s, without a break in its chain of custody. Prior to that, there are gaps in its history, which of course gives the skeptics all the ammunition they need to challenge it. But there was a cloth that was, first of all, we can go all the way back to the Gospels, where it's mentioned in the Gospels that there was a burial shroud that was provided by Joseph of Arimathea. People always say, well, why wasn't the image on the shroud mentioned in the Gospels? And that's very simple. It's forbidden by Jewish law to have any depictions of God. And so it also has blood on it, which is required by Jewish law to be buried. So nobody could come running out of the tomb saying, look what we found, without putting themselves at great risk. For a few hundred years, I'm sure it was just hidden away to keep it away from iconoclasts and those who would destroy it, or even the people who might have protected it. In the 4th and 5th centuries, the first image we see that looks like the Man of the Shroud is about 285 A.D. in the Comitia Catacombs in Rome. In the 4th and 5th century, the iconography of the Orthodox Church started making paintings that look exactly like the Man on the Shroud, with many identifying marks that are very consistent with what's on the shroud itself. There was then another gap in its history. There was a cloth that was in Constantinople or Edessa, and that was known as the mandilion, which means in Greek, not made by human hands, or in other words, not an artwork. That disappeared, I think, in about 1204 when the Crusaders came and sacked the city, and this mandilion cloth had been walled up in the wall of the city to hide it and protect it. It disappeared, never to be seen there again. And about 150 years later, it shows up in the hands of a French crusader in the 1300s. And from there, its history is unbroken until today. So that's sort of a brief overview of its history. A lot more detail on shroud.com, of course.
And Barry, what came first, the depictions of Jesus that we have all known over the years with, you know, the robe, the beard, the long hair? Mm-hmm. Did that come first, or was it the shroud that came first in terms of people's identification with what Jesus may or may not have looked like?
Well, I think that probably the earliest solid depictions were would have been in the 4th and 5th century in the Orthodox Church. And there's a very famous artwork called the Christ Pantocrator that looks very much like the Man of the Shroud. And most people that have studied this believe that that image, that Christ Pantocrator artwork, was based itself on the Shroud. So I would have to say the Shroud came first.
Now, of course, Jesus was tortured before he was put to death. They put, you know, thorns around his head. They speared him in the side when he was on the cross. They hammered him in the legs and in his palms of his hand. Does the Shroud depict some of those wound areas?
Actually, George, it depicts all of them, as you describe. And interestingly enough, we talk about a crown of thorns. We've looked at artworks throughout religious art history, and you'll see the crown of thorns typically depicted as a kind of a circlet around the head. Interestingly enough, that comes from the first century, where artists would depict people of great stature with a laurel wreath around their head. And so the crown of thorns, at least in artworks, was always shown as kind of a circular wreath around the head. But the Man of the Shroud has bloodstains covering his entire scalp, and that implies that they didn't take the time to weave a pretty crown for this man. They were this criminal, ostensibly, that they were about to execute. They just took a nasty thorn bush and smashed it on his head. So the motif of the circlet comes from the artworks of the first century. But the reality, at least, of what we see on the Shroud is the entire scalp is covered with wounds, implying that they probably just smashed the whole thorn bush down onto his head, causing wounds across the entire scalp.
Can you tell how tall the individual was?
Well, we can, but not as precisely as we'd like. First of all, you have to remember it's a woven cloth, and so it can be stretched in any direction, and we had to be very careful in 78. Not to stretch it and distort the image on it. We had to smooth it out without pulling too tight and stretching the image. The other thing about the Shroud's image is, unlike an artwork that has a defined edge, like an artwork or a properly focused photograph, the edge of the image of the Shroud just fades out. So it's hard to know exactly where to start and end your measurements. And because of that, and the fact that the cloth can change its shape based just on the relative humidity in which it's stored by as much as a few centimeters, we can only do an approximation of about 5'10", 5'11", as the man on the Shroud's height.
Can you tell how much he weighed by that?
You know, I'm sure that others who have studied the Shroud and done the more anthropological kinds of studies have come up with that. I don't really recall off the top. It's a good question, George, not one anybody's asked me lately. But I would guess perhaps 160, 175 pounds. That would be a guess.
Interesting. Interesting take of all this. Now, the Shroud itself, does it travel around? Do people have a chance to see it, or do they keep it in Turin?
It's kept in Turin, and it's generally brought out. Historically, it was about four times each century, about every 25 years or so. In the more recent era, starting in 1978, of course, when we examined it, it was again shown in 1998, then in 2000, then in 2010 and 2015. So it's had a lot more exposure over the last 40 or so years than historically. The next scheduled public exhibition is at least tentatively set for 2025, which also happens to be the next holy year of the Catholic Church. And so we're all anticipating that about a year before before the actual exhibition of the Shroud, the folks in Turin will put on their website a reservation form. It doesn't cost anything to go to see the Shroud, but they do require a reservation. You can now do that online. And so they tell you, don't show up early, show up at the time you've selected. And the lines, which back in 1978 were as long as 10 hours before you got in to see the Shroud, 100,000 or more people lined up, queued up to see it. Now it's 15 to 20 minutes, maybe on the weekends about an hour. So it's much more efficient because of the Internet and the opportunity for people to make reservations. We expect that that website to go online about a year before the actual next public exhibition.
Wasn't a small piece of it the carbon dated, DeBerry, but there's some controversy over whether some pollen may have gotten on it or something like that?
Well, the controversy, certainly there was a radiocarbon dating done in 1988, and three laboratories were chosen to do so, Zurich in Switzerland, Oxford in England, and Arizona here in the U.S. And those three labs were each given a small piece. One little piece was cut from one corner of the cloth, divided in half, one half set aside, the other half divided into thirds by weight, and given to the three laboratories. They came up with a date range of 1260 to 1390, saying that it's impossible for the shroud to be any older than 1260. Of course, those of us who'd been studying the shroud knew that there was strong evidence, historical evidence in the historical record showing the evidence of the shroud existing well before the earliest date given by the carbon dating. But for many years, that, you know, the whole world just sort of accepted, well, can't be old enough, so it mustn't be real. It wasn't until about 12 years later, around 2000, that a theory was proposed stating that there was nothing wrong with the carbon dating, only the choice of a single sample from that corner. Turns out that that sample was anomalous, that apparently there was cotton interwoven, which is, by the way, forbidden by Jewish law, mixing of the kinds, it's called. And so that date, there are now three papers in the peer-reviewed literature challenging the radiocarbon dating. The first two came out, one in 2005, then in 2008. And most recently, just a few weeks ago, a third paper came out. Now, interestingly enough, George, for the 27 years after the radiocarbon dating, the three laboratories refused to release the raw data.
Why?
Well, that was what we were wondering. Why? Well, in 2017, an Italian researcher, Tristan Casabianca, using the Freedom of Information Act in England, went to the British Museum and literally forced them to release the data. The reason the British Museum had it was that the chief researcher at the British Museum at the time, Michael Tite, was appointed as supervisor over the three labs to make sure everything was done correctly. Ironically, as soon as the radiocarbon dating results came out, £1 million was anonymously donated to the Oxford lab, and Dr. Michael Tite left the British Museum and took a permanent chair at Oxford. That didn't look so good. Well, anyway, in 2017, using the Freedom of Information Act, the British Museum ultimately released the raw data, and a new paper came out just a few weeks ago. We'll be featuring it in our next update on shroud.com on June 3rd or maybe the 4th. And that paper further supports the questionable content of the single sample chosen for dating. So there's now a third peer-reviewed article.
Perfect.
That challenges the radiocarbon dating in the peer-reviewed literature.
Barry, is the image like a negative, a photographic negative?
It is. The lights and darks of the image on the shroud are the reverse of what we look at. You know, we're used to seeing light highlights and dark shadows. And the image on the shroud is, in fact, the inverse of that. Now, being an old-school analog photographer, I spent many, many years in the darkroom, and when I first looked at the actual shroud, I could immediately see that what was on that cloth had the appearance of a photo negative to me. Now, I don't want to imply that the shroud was made photographically, because there was no silver, which would have been the light-sensitive material necessary for photography. There was no silver found anywhere on that cloth.
And it's not a painting.
And it's not a painting, you know. Our team in 78 went there to answer the single question, how is the image formed? And we were unable to answer that. We were able to come back and tell you what it's not. It's not a painting, it's not a scorch, and it's not a photograph. Those were the three kind of common suggestions for what might have formed the image. So we can tell you it's not any of those, but we don't know of a mechanism that can create an image with those chemical and physical properties to this day. And in all the attempts in the last 40 or so years to duplicate the shroud, many by people using one of my photographs of the shroud as a basis for their work, no one has ever come close to matching all of the chemical and physical properties of the Shroud's image.
Several years ago, CNN did a documentary basically called Finding Jesus, and they highlighted the Shroud. What were their conclusions, Barry?
Well, I hate to say it, but I've pretty much given up on television documentaries about the Shroud. And, George, I've appeared in about 20 of them.
I know, yeah.
And, you know, I can only recommend two after all that. And so I was not very happy with that particular documentary because they dug out some very visual things that had long before been proven erroneous, one of them being the theory of a gentleman named Nicholas Allen, a South African art historian, who claims that the Shroud was made photographically. And ironically, he said that they used silver, and then they removed all the silver and fixed the image using the man's urine. Effectively, Nicholas Allen said they created the Shroud of urine, I guess. At any rate, the frustration is this. There is only one property of the Shroud's image that is similar to a photograph, and that's the light and dark reversal that we've already mentioned. But every other aspect of that image is unlike any other photograph that I've ever seen, and I've seen quite a few in my almost 50-year career. Probably the most unique property of the image, the property of the image that hooked me when they asked me to join the team, the property that ultimately sort of prompted me to actually join that team, is the fact that there's spatial or depth information or topographic information, often referred to as 3D information, encoded into the lights and darks of the Shroud's image. And that's something that no one has been able to duplicate, and there's no simple solution to how an image might form that way.
Barry, how did you get involved in this project?
Well, you know, as a professional photographer, I had a photographic studio in Santa Barbara, California at the time, and I had been contracted by one of the local technical companies. They were a contractor to Los Alamos National Labs, and they contracted me as a photographic consultant for a 7-month project. And, of course, it was Los Alamos, so obviously it had something to do with atomic bombs, and I can't really say much more about it. But for 7 months, we did that project, and I worked with a gentleman named Don Devan, who was an imaging scientist working for that subcontractor company. A few weeks after we finished that project, he called me again. And, you know, when you're self-employed and the phone rings, you're hoping it's the next project. But he called me again, and I thought, aha, another project with Don. And instead, he said, Barry, what do you know about the Shroud of Turin? And I kind of laughed, and I said, but Don, I'm Jewish. And Don laughed and said, so am I, remember? He's one of the other Jewish guys on our team. And he was the one who was there when they took an image of the Shroud, a photograph of the Shroud, put it into an instrument called the VP8 Image Analyzer, which took the lights and the darks of the image and stretched them into 3D vertical space on a green screen monitor, proportionate to each other. And when they did that with a normal photo, you get a jumble of shapes that make no sense at all. When you do it with the Shroud image, you get the natural relief of a human form. And it was that property, that encoding of depth information into the image, that actually prompted the formation of the Shroud of Turin Research Project. When they saw that, that was the first time that a scientific instrument visualized that property. So that was sort of the milestone of the moment. And that was the catalyst for our team to be formed. And although initially I was hesitant to participate, it was that image property, more than anything else, that prompted me to say yes to joining the team. Although I have to admit, even though I know there's a million or so people listening out there, I was also thinking free trip to Italy, George.
Interesting take. Barry, we're going to come back and talk more about the Shroud of Turin next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. We will take calls with Barry Schwartz next hour as we talk about the Shroud of Turin and his work associated with that. Barry, I guess we can assume for a moment here that Jesus was a real human being. He did exist. Let's not debate the merits of his miraculous powers at this point. But he was a person who was persecuted for whatever things he did at the time. But what this tells me, and what the Shroud may tell me, is if, for example, Noah's Ark exists somewhere, and the Shroud is authentic and real, that the stories in the Bible may very well be accurate. What do you think?
Well, you know, that's certainly beyond my expertise. I'm not a biblical scholar, but from the amount of work that I've done over the years in studying the Gospels relevant to the Shroud, I would have to say that there's obviously some veracity to it. Remember that we have four different accounts of what was done to Jesus. They're reasonably accurate to each other and consistent with each other. So I think that, you know, we really have no other basis. That is the basis for our knowledge of the Shroud and the fact that Jesus was wrapped in a shroud, which, by the way, is very typical of an Orthodox Jewish burial, even to this day. My father, when he died in 2003, well, he was wrapped in a shroud in a plain pine wooden coffin. So a very simple Orthodox Jewish burial.
But not every shroud gives an image.
Well, you know, the one thing that I have to remind people is that typically the shroud wraps the body. Both are organic, both decompose. So we don't have intact shrouds left over from the remains of those who were wrapped in it and decomposed in their own cloth. What we have here with the Shroud of Turin is a cloth that was obviously separated from the body probably in about 36 hours. So what we have on the shroud that bears an image, we don't know if other shrouds may have borne images over the centuries because we don't have any intact shrouds to examine. The only one we have is the Shroud of Turin, and of course that one shows no signs of decomposition, which, by the way, is consistent with the prophecies of the Old Testament that when the Messiah comes, he would be not corrupted, or in other words, would not be decomposed.
What's your gut tell you about the shroud at this point?
I tell you what, it took me 17 years after handling it and examining it and leaving my own DNA on it, but it took 17 years, and it was the science that ultimately convinced me. Remember, I was raised in an Orthodox Jewish home, so I didn't have an emotional attachment to the subject matter. In fact, at the very beginning, I was really skeptical, and I made a foolish statement that, oh, give us 5 minutes and we'll find the paint and come home. Well, there was no paint.
There's not no paint.
42 years later, I'm still doing it, George.
I mean, Jesus was real, even from the Jewish perspective. Now, you don't believe as a Jew that he was the Messiah, but you do believe he exists as a human, right?
Absolutely. And look, even the question of the Messiah, you know, Orthodox Jews did not accept Jesus because, according to the prophecies, when the Messiah came, there would be world peace. That didn't occur, obviously. Christians believe in the second coming, when the rest of the prophecies will be fulfilled. Again, you know, theology is not my strong point, and I defer that usually to those who are far more qualified than I am. But my gut feeling is, yeah, I guess the best answer is what my little Jewish mother said after she heard one of my lectures in person for the first time. I was back in Pittsburgh for my high school reunion, my 40th reunion. My Catholic friend said, why don't you give a shroud lecture while you're here? The Archdiocese of Pittsburgh gave me a venue, put me on the radio, put me in the bulletins. We had a wonderful, huge event. Lots of people came. We were driving home. Of course, my mother was there, my cousins, my brother, you know, the whole family. We were driving home, and my mother was silent. And when a Jewish mother is silent, George, be afraid.
Oy vey, right?
Oy vey is right. So she was silent, and I just couldn't handle it anymore. I finally said to her, well, what do you think? Now, this is a woman who was born in Poland, immigrated as the youngest of four kids at age 7 from Poland to the U.S., high school education, not a sophisticated woman, not a highly educated woman. And so I said to her, well, what do you think? And she turned to me and she said, well, of course, it's authentic. Well, I was shocked.
Wow.
It took me 17 years after I physically looked at it before I was convinced. She hears one lecture and she's convinced. So I said, Mother, what makes you say that? And she looked at me, and you know how mothers get that condescending tone of voice that they get sometimes. She said, Barry, they wouldn't have kept it for 2,000 years. If it belonged to anyone else, it wouldn't have mattered. Well, I kind of laughed at that at first until I realized what a profound observation she had made. Whoever rescued the shroud out of the tomb put themselves at great risk.
Yes.
Because it contains blood, needs to be buried with the body. bears an image still forbidden to this day by Jews and Muslims alike. And so whoever rescued it put themselves at risk. And my mother kind of summed that up in one little sentence. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized how profound an observation that was. If that cloth had belonged to anyone else, who would have cared? Who would have bothered to keep it? Who would have put themselves at risk to keep something unless it belonged to someone important enough to make it worthy of keeping and preserving and, you know, passing it down?
Now, Jesus did not incite violence. I mean, he went nuts once with the money changers in the so-called church areas.
Well, yeah, in the there were money lenders' tables in the temple, and he walked in and knocked them over. But think about this, George. He interfered with commerce. Now, if somebody went to New York and unplugged Wall Street, if they survived the first 24 hours, they'd be in Guantanamo the next day.
Yeah.
You know, and so he interfered with commerce, and he saw the hypocrisy of that, and he stood up against it. And, of course, that was the big crime he really committed, was interfering with the commerce of the day.
Well, that's a good point. Yeah. So, but why kill the guy?
Well, you know, that's a question I'm not able to answer, George. All I know is what it tells us was done, and ultimately they tortured and killed him. And, you know, I've often said in my lectures to people that set aside for a minute all the religious and theological implications, just look at him as a human being. He's a man who was willing to die a horrible death for something he believed in. You know, you have to hold a man of that stature in high regard, because it takes a lot of courage to stand up for what you believe in and withstand the tortures that were applied and do so willingly. So one has to admire him, even if you're not a Christian. I think he's well admired. I mean, even the Muslims, where I go each year, this year will be my fifth year, to speak to the Ahmadiyya Muslims in England, addressing 35,000 of them at a time. And they hold Jesus in high regard. They call him Isa. They believe, however, that unlike Christians' belief that Jesus was resurrected, they believe that he survived the tortures that were applied to him, including the crucifixion and the spearing in the side. And there's a tomb in Kashmir that they believe is the tomb of Jesus. So, you know, each religion has some interest in the shroud, although Judaism is the one that has the least interest. And my Jewish friends kind of shrug their shoulders and say, well, you know, it doesn't matter to us. We haven't accepted him as the Messiah, so we don't care.
Now, you talked about blood on the shroud. If this is Jesus and it's his blood, can it be DNA'd? Can we get the DNA of Jesus?
Well, you know, there was a book called The DNA of God, and it was based on a set of DNA tests that were performed in 1995 at the University of Texas Health Science Center, and they determined that it was normal male chromosomes. They did say type AB blood, although that is somewhat in question, knowing now that we have more modern DNA analysis techniques. But the problem is that they determined that there were not enough segments to complete a DNA profile. And I have to remind people all the time, DNA is comparative analysis. You have a DNA you find at a crime scene, and you find a guy, and you match up the DNA, and boom, the crime is solved. Nobody has the DNA profile of Jesus of Nazareth, so we really don't have a lot to compare to. And the other problem, maybe the bigger problem, is contamination. That cloth has been handled by hundreds, if not thousands, of people over the centuries.
Exactly.
And each of us is constantly shedding our epithelial cells. I mean, you know, in almost an invisible cloud around each of us. And so everybody that has come in close contact with that cloth has also left their DNA on it. Sadly, in 2002, a sort of clandestine restoration was performed on the cloth. And there was a Swiss woman who was given the task. She removed the patches that had been sewn in after the fire of 1532. She scraped away the charred areas from all the burnt areas. They steamed it and vacuumed it, steamed it to get out the wrinkles, vacuumed it to get up any loose debris, which eliminates, by the way, any future pollen testing. They sewed a wider sheet, a newer sheet behind it. Nobody did any chemical analysis of that new sheet to determine if the cloth had been treated in a way that might be harmful to the shroud. It's been attached to the back of the shroud now for 17 years. And the woman who did the work with her lady assistant, neither of them wore gloves, hairnets, masks, or protective clothing. So I'm afraid if we did a DNA analysis of the man of the shroud today, we'd find he was a Swiss woman.
What does it tell you if the shroud is authentic? What happened, who this man was?
Well, it sort of certainly supports the gospel narrative of what was done to Jesus of Nazareth, the tortures that were applied to him. They're all documented on this cloth with forensic accuracy, which is something I have to underline to remind people that no medieval artist had the forensic skills to fake this. This is, I believe, there was an interaction between the cloth and the body that formed the image. The blood stains were transferred by direct contact. They soak into the cloth and through the cloth. They're visible on the reverse side of the cloth. The blood stains are. The image is just a few microns thick on the top surface of the top fibrils, does not penetrate into the cloth. And that's one of the things that eliminates the possibility of any paints or pigments to be applied, because by capillarity, they would have soaked into the cloth and we would have found, you know, paint particles trapped between the fibers. We found none of those, and that includes in the photomicroscopy that we did of the blood and image areas on the cloth.
Scientifically, what could put an image like that on a cloth?
Well, you know, George, if I could answer that question, I could probably go do something else. I think that was the biggest frustration of the STIRP team once we completed our work. We came back from Turin. We spent 17 months preparing to go. We spent 5 days and nights actually collecting the data directly from the cloth. And then we spent the next 3 years after we came back producing that data, writing it into papers, submitting it to, and having it published into top-notch peer-reviewed journals. And that forms the primary database of scientific knowledge of the shroud to this day. So after that three-year period of time, the team tried to put together a second go-around to go back and answer some of the new questions that had been raised by the data that we collected, and to further explore the image on the shroud to see if we can get a better answer to how it might have formed. Although we submitted that to Cardinal Ratzinger, who eventually became Pope Benedict, and he passed it on to Pope John Paul II at the time, he approved it, thought it was a good proposal. There were 26 tests, 25 different scientific tests, plus the 26th test being radiocarbon dating. Ultimately, the Pontifical Scientific Academy convinced the Pope that that he shouldn't allow the Americans to handle the shroud again, that they might cause it harm. And so they threw away the 25 tests that might have helped answer some of the questions that were raised, you know, by our new data and to further our knowledge. And all they did was the radiocarbon dating, which we've already discussed. And so it was kind of frustrating, and that was the end of our team, and there was no more STIRP team after that.
Well, you've ruled out a painting. What else can you rule out?
Well, we can rule out photography. As I said earlier, photography requires a light-sensitive material, and historically that has been silver. So one of the tests that we were performing, we were looking for silver. We were using spectral analysis, pyrolysis mass spectrometry that's capable of detecting one part per billion with a B, and we found no silver anywhere on the shroud. And obviously, had the image been created photographically, where there was visible image, there would have been a higher amount of silver than in the non-image areas, and we found zero silver anywhere on the shroud. So we've been able to eliminate photography as a mechanism for creating the image. And as I said, it has properties unlike any other photograph. Normal two-dimensional photography doesn't encode depth information into it. Depth information is simply implied by using highlights and shadows. That's what we photographers are trained to do. And so we eliminated photography. The other possibility that was suggested by someone you know, George, Joe Nickel,
yeah,
was that somebody...
But Joe's a skeptic, right?
Oh, yeah, he's a total skeptic. And there's a Shroud conference coming up in August in Canada, and Joe's been invited, so he's going to be the lone voice of skepticism amongst a bunch of Shroudies. And I'm looking forward to finally meeting him in person. You know, he and I debated on your show some years ago.
Yeah, he's a nice guy.
I respect Joe, and I appreciate him being willing to come to an event that's going to be mostly pro-Shroud people. And to be I think there'll be one or two other skeptics in the crowd, but he'll be the most prominent one there. And so, skepticism is fine. The other thing, it was Joe's theory about the hot statue. And so, look, there are burn marks on the shroud from a documented fire in 1532, and those burn marks include scorches and actual burn holes. And so if the shroud had been created, if the shroud image had been created by the heated statue that Joe Nickell proposed when we did ultraviolet fluorescence photography on the shroud, which reveals things that we would not normally see with our eye in invisible light, we found that all the known scorches on the shroud fluoresce in the red. The background of the cloth fluoresces a sort of yellow-green. The image not only does not fluoresce, it quenches the fluorescence of the background as well. So the image itself, based on that set of tests, cannot be the product of a high temperature event, or in other words, it's not a scorch.
Bingo. So what else could it be? We'll talk more with Barry and take your calls next on Coast to Coast AM.